Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, Greece, of course. First, in moments, we'll hear from Nantina Vagonsis, who's been all over Athens in recent weeks. And at the bottom of the hour, Mark Blythe will tell us how blaming Greece gets the French and German banks off the hook. The Greek crisis, after many months of fruitless negotiations between the country and its creditors, looks to be coming to a head. The creditors, led by Germany, have told Greece to come up with an acceptable, to them, plan by Sunday. If they don't, well, then it's not clear exactly what will happen, but it looks like they'll kick Greece out of the euro, even though there's no provision in EU law for such a thing to happen. The Treaty of Accession to the euro says entry is irrevocable, but apparently when Angela Merkel wants to make an example of you, law is a mere technicality. First, Nantina Vagonsis. She's a graduate student in sociology at NYU, also active in the union there, who's been writing about the Greek crisis for Jacobin magazine. She has an excellent analysis of what's been going on the ground and the politics of the government's negotiating strategy as well. Nantina Vagonsis. Pretty heady times there in the streets of Athens, I guess. What have you been up to?
I've just been following some of the more on-the-ground mobilizations. Last week, it was mainly the left outside Syriza that was mobilizing around the no vote, and that mainly took the form of flyering people in neighborhoods, outside workplaces. There were some comrades who even went to factories at 5 in the morning. You know, I think that filled actually two voids. One was that left by the Communist Party's decision to abstain from the vote. Their line was that they were actually giving a double no, a no to austerity, but also no to austerity under Syriza. And, you know, they've been pursuing this line for years now that the conditions aren't ripe yet for rupture, especially in the way that Syriza is pursuing it, is not favorable for revolutionary interventions. So that abstention created the void of the most organized sections of the working class in Greece not having some kind of political direction in voting no. And so that's why I appreciate especially, you know, the kinds of firings outside of workplaces, including factories in the western suburbs of Athens and also the ports in Piraeus. And then the second void that they filled were those, what really was that created by the Syriza leadership itself. And I think the left outside Greece has taken note that the Syriza leadership in pursuing, you know, this strategy of negotiations with kind of a good faith in its European partners, or at least in its ability to build alliances with certain sections of its European partners, has not been able to focus on the kinds of mobilization efforts that actually brought it to power. You saw that last week in several ways. The first was that the start of the week, there was kind of this vacillation by the administration itself. I don't know if you saw on Tuesday, Tsipras was sending these kind of proposals to Brussels after calling a referendum. So that was really paradoxical. And there's suspicion that that might have been a result of, you know, internal battles within the leadership that prompted Tsipras to do that. But, you know, then by Wednesday, he finally stood firm about the referendum. What I'm saying is that the first part of the week, it wasn't even really clarified whether the referendum would actually happen. And so, you know, the mobilization on the ground by the party was just totally absent. And that's why on Friday, you know, when that big rally happened, it was really a surprise to a lot of us that so many people came out. For me, the big take-home there was that given the lack of political direction, both from Syriza and from other parts of the left, people really are just fed up with austerity. And possibly we could interpret that they're willing to take a step into the unknown without that unknown being clarified by people who are more in the know. That's really you know, the kind of dynamic of last week.
Now, do you think that Tsipras made a mistake in carrying on the negotiations for all these months? What else could he have done or should he have done?
Well, I've been public in my critiques since February that he and his team could have been tougher leading up to the agreement on February 20th. They had the same sort of blackmail pulled on them leading up to that. The ELA, the Emergency Liquidity Assistance, again, you know, was threatened. And, you know, at that point, they could have imposed capital controls, the kind of thing that they did when they called the referendum. They didn't do it because, you know, they really believed, again, in the good euro strategy And it was not even a month since they were elected that they were called, you know, to make their first major agreement. And so, you know, they signed the deal. And then the dynamic of, you know, the next 3 to 4 months was one of the ECB rationing out just enough to keep the Greek banking system going. And in the meantime, the government was mostly preoccupied with the negotiations and couldn't really focus, you know, I talked about mobilization, let alone just governing in general. And, you know, each time that a payment would come up, we would hear the same line, which is that pensions and wages, at the very least, wouldn't be sacrificed for payments to the IMF or the ECB. And the government just creatively found other ways to ensure both forms of payments. And that really started coming to a climax in May, when it ransacked the municipal funds in order to be able to pay both. It also had actually ransacked other ministries, significantly the health ministry prior to that. And so effectively, actually, people weren't getting their payments. You know, you had people in you know, the health workforce weren't getting paid for months. And so the situation of their own ministry being ransacked didn't help with that. And so that started taking a toll, too. And then at the end of May, leading into the week of June 5th, again, they said that, you know, this might be the moment of a more kind of confrontational approach to the ECB and to the EU in general, and that, you know, they might not make their payment. And again, that was postponed. It was just this dynamic of postponing. And in the meantime, implicit message for those of us outside the negotiating room was that they were very committed to getting an agreement with the creditors, maybe at cost of their anti-austerity platform. And I have to say, I think actually a lot of people, or, you know, there was a good chunk of the voters who voted for Syriza who actually didn't expect Syriza to meet all its promises and all its rhetoric, and knew that they would have to pursue, you know, a rupturalist strategy in order to really meet those promises. So you could say that they were giving what they had, you know, implicitly promised, or that, you know, people didn't have very high expectations. But the referendum changed that. I think the referendum did raise people's expectations again. And at this point, because we are, again, looking at a strategy of compromise, this is what the past few days, and especially today, has shown us. If that happens, I think they'll face critique from a larger part of their base.
I think almost everyone's expecting a pretty narrow margin in the referendum, and the financial markets look like they're expecting a yes. It turned out, of course, a very large margin no. Was that surprising? And why do you think there was such a, you know, 20-21 point margin in the end?
That was a surprise to many of us, you know, including members of Syriza, including the leadership. And like I said, you know, up to Friday, despite the really great efforts of some comrades on the ground, you didn't see a lot of traffic by the no side. Of course, you saw a lot of propaganda from the yes side. And already, you know, people in the private media are being called into disciplinary committees of the Union of Journalists for their role in that. But on the no side, you know, things were quiet, relatively. And then, you know, Friday, again, the rally, it really changed my impression of what might happen. And it reminded me of the same feeling that I had 2 years earlier when the ERT public broadcaster was shut down by the New Democracy government. And I remember that clearly. I was living here at the time. It was a Tuesday night. And at the time, I was participating, you know, as a badly contracted journalist with a Greek newspaper in this media workers' assembly. And our assemblies would happen every Tuesday. And I had reached a point, you know, it was June, where, you know, after going to these assemblies for a full month, and, you know, this was the period of demobilization, I myself wasn't inspired to go to the assembly. And then it turned out that there was a call, because the broadcaster was being shut down, to go to their headquarters. And I, you know, I didn't field that inspired going, and this is as someone who was going weekly to assemblies around media issues. And at the end, I did end up going, but I guess I'm just giving a sense of how I was surprised then to find tens of thousands of ordinary citizens who just, you know, went because they felt that enough was enough. And I think that was the same situation on Friday, magnified, you know, by 10 degrees. There were, you know, over 100,000 people there, maybe even nearing 200,000 people. Anyway, I think that changed the dynamic and our expectations of what could happen. Again, I still didn't expect it to be 60 to 40. I thought, you know, at the highest it could be 55. But, you know, I think it's a testament to people's, you know, refusal of what they've been going through for the past 5 years.
Greece is in an extremely weak position negotiating. It's facing extremely adamant creditors who want to make an example of the country and are willing, really, to just shoot Greece in order to make sure that no one else follows its example. What could the government do under these circumstances? What negotiation position could it have adopted?
I think they could have adopted a position of at least showing that they were ready for exit. Because then at that point, you know, I do think that there were certain measures that they could have and that they could still take that wouldn't be as strong now, but, you know, that could still help with the immediate consequences that would make the creditors think a bit more about kicking them out, because there are two scenarios if they kick them out. You know, one is that the government is prepared, you know, is ready to impose capital controls, nationalize the banks, ensure that they're able to manage the liquidity crisis. At this point, with the banks privately owned, you don't know. You don't know if there are actually deposits that are being protected. So if it's under state control, it's easier to manage that. There could be an introduction of parallel currency in the form of IOU. There could also be plans for certain kinds of rationing. Once you show that you're ready, you know, the creditors might have to think once again, because if the country is able to show that within, you know, 5 months to a year, it can really recover, and then finally it's able to get out of, you know, the bondage of austerity and actually start showing, you know, true signs of growth, start attacking this mass unemployment of 25% of the past 5 years, then maybe other, you know, southern members of the monetary union might also fall in that route. And then, you know, that might actually start threatening the foundations of the Eurozone, which I claim, you know, is still integral to the growth strategy of the northern core of Europe. So that's why I think, you know, being prepared would have actually strengthened their bargaining position. Now, if they're not prepared, then, as you said, the creditors can pursue a very hardline strategy of making an example out of a country that isn't able to deal with, you know, the chaotic aftermath of exiting from the Eurozone and not having the cash in the ATM machine, for starters. And then, you know, that might be able to discipline other members that may have otherwise flirted with exiting. And, you know, that might show a lesson to the public of other countries where you see other anti-austerity parties emerging. And, you know, that might not be as inspired to vote them into power. And you can see those parties on their own actually turning to the right, Sinn Féin in Ireland and Podemos in Spain. You know, Pablo Iglesias the other week made a speech, you know, distancing himself not just from Syriza but from Greece itself, saying that, oh, you know, Spain, we're a more productive country, we're basically a more integral country to the Eurozone. So yeah, I do think that they could have done things to strengthen their bargaining position.
I'm speaking with Nantina Vakonsis in Athens. I had Yanis Varoufakis on my show 16 times before he hit the big time. The last time I interviewed him, which was, I believe, last October or November, he said you have to be willing to blow things up in order to be effective in a negotiating strategy. It looked like they were not willing to blow things up, at least until recently. Is that correct?
Yeah. And you could say, you know, was it too late when they finally did decide to blow things up?
What do you think is going to happen? The creditors have given, this weekend is a deadline. I don't think there's going to be any movement on either side. It looks like we're heading towards some sort of, not resolution, but some sort of climax to this melodrama in a few days. What do you see happening in the near future?
Unfortunately, I do think we might see movement from the Greek side. Already, the new finance minister, Efthymios Tsakalotos, sent a letter to the creditors today, you know, at the same time that Tsipras was saying that Greece was being used as a laboratory for austerity, the finance minister was sending a letter saying that they are going to make their proposals, and you know the deadline for that is Thursday. And he already gave some hints as to what we'd expect from those. And I mean, for me, the most alarming part of that letter was that they said that Greece would, I don't remember the exact phrase, but it was something to the extent of Greece would welcome exploring the possibilities of debt relief. You know, that's not a very strong statement or demand for debt reduction. Supposedly, that was one of the conditions that finally Tsipras decided to not take the agreement, to leave Brussels and to call the referendum. So to say, you know, in this initial letter that was released finally publicly, that they would just, you know, welcome exploring the possibilities for debt relief shows to me that they might make movement on that. They're looking at a 3-year bailout program. And if you don't have conditions for debt relief on that, I'm very worried that that's the sign of capitulation. But they're still facing internal pressures. There's a significant chunk of the party, you know, not just, you know, the party dissidents from years back, but people increasingly who, especially given the results of the referendum, are, to adopt the phrase of my comrades, are, you know, committed to taking no to the end and to not capitulating on Sunday. So I think the situation is still fluid, but I'm worried that they're not boldly presenting a plan for, you know, a more ruptural scenario. There is still the possibility that they can't do that. They just can't do that publicly at this point. And I'm really hoping that's the case. I'm really hoping that we'll be surprised, as we were with the referendum, and that there's, you know, this small group of technocrats that's working on a plan that will be publicized and that will involve the participation of the public come Sunday. But, you know, I think we're already seeing signs of compromise.
What's your reading on why Varoufakis resigned?
So in the beginning, you know, like most people, I thought that it was kind of an Iphigenia, a sacrifice by Tsipras to ditch someone who was not agreeable to his counterparts in the Eurogroup and to, you know, bring, you know, kind of a softer guy. Although we should note that Tsakalotos actually is politically to the left of the dominant faction, of Tsipras' faction, in the way that Varoufakis wasn't. But at this point, I don't think that that influences too much the role that he's playing. That's been the main interpretation. I have to say that after Tsakalotos sent that letter today, part of me, you know, suspects that it could very well be that Varoufakis was very serious about his statements last week, you know, that he gave to multiple reporters, that he was not willing to sign another extended pretend agreement. And if you're agreeing to a bailout program that doesn't have conditions for debt relief, effectively, you're signing on to that. So it could be, you know, that he had sensed that after the referendum, regardless of the result, there would be, you know, another shift to compromise. And he didn't want to be a part of that. But, you know, these are just speculations.
And how's the popular mood holding up after, now we're in the second week without a banking system? How are people holding up under these circumstances?
Well, it depends on what sections of society, right? And I think, you know, the results of the referendum helped confirm that. For a large part of the society, that doesn't have a lot on the banks anyway, people weren't that alarmed that they had to ration how much they could take out of the bank. You know, most people wouldn't be able to take 6 euros out consecutively every day anyway. And, you know, there was this great moment when, you know, the reporters, they were just bombarding outside the ATM lines every day. And at one point, you know, this one reporter went up to someone and, you know, this woman got in between and said, "Stop pounding us here and go report on actual news." You know, but this isn't to make light of, you know, the increasing liquidity crisis that, of course, everyone is aware of. I guess I'm just pointing to, right, the people who, you know, are especially worried about their own assets. And, of course, you know, that's people with money in the banks. And, you know, they're worried of the possible scenario that you had in Cyprus with a haircut on deposits. And, you know, here it said that there wouldn't be a haircut on deposits of less than 8,000 euros. So again, you know, that's a specific part of the population that would be worried. You know, small business owners are, of course, been worried from the start, and they've reacted in different ways. I've heard stories of small business owners, you know, making, you know, part of their workforce and take time off as a way of, you know, starting to incrementally lay people off. You know, you also had stories of business owners telling their workforce that if they voted no, and if no, you know, was the result, then they might not have a job in 5 months. So it's, you know, it's a mix of kind of this terrorizing by property owners with not an immediate concern by most of the population, but, you know, just a sense that, of course, things are coming to a head, and people know that the situation is getting tough.
And do you think the population would be supportive of the government if they actually took the exit route and started to create a parallel currency or a scrip or IOUs or whatever funny money solutions people have been talking about? Do they even have the technical capacity to do that at this point? But do you think the population would be supportive if they did take that route?
I think if the government were clear with their plan, were very frank about the difficulties, but also, you know, the possibilities for growth, you know, at least in the medium term, people would have patience. That, for me, was a sign of a 60% no vote. People voted to do that in for a reason. I think, like I said, their own expectations were raised by the referendum. Yeah, they are saying that enough is enough, that they are willing to take a dip into the unknown. And so they know that, you know, if it comes to that, they'll have to tolerate it. But you don't know. We don't know how different, you know, political tendencies are going to try to mobilize around it. I mean, I am very confident that the left, you know, some of the left within Citizen, some of the left outside of it, is going to play a positive role in that sense. And, you know, it's going to politicize people around this, educate them around it, get them organized in a local way around this. But at the same time, a big part of the direction is going to have to come from the government. And I hope that, you know, they're prepared to deal with that.
Only got a minute or two left, but is the far right making any hay out of this chaos?
So the far right had an interesting intervention. So Golden Dawn, which remains the third largest party in the country, at the beginning took a very firm stance with no. And it's difficult to interpret exactly why they chose that. You know, popularly, they try to present themselves as anti-systemic, while at the same time serving very systemic interests. So it might just, you know, have been part of maintaining their popular image, especially at a time when, you know, they're ostensibly pretty unpopular and undergoing trial by the state. But they didn't mobilize on the ground around that. And that's not because they're dormant in general. They actually are active around specific initiatives. For instance, they just opened a company union and a site where they attacked unionists and that they're now being prosecuted for. So they're active in some ways. I don't think they're active around central initiatives. It's difficult to know exactly why they're acting in this way at this point. But, you know, there is a big fear that if, you know, the government isn't ready, and if, you know, a more ruptural situation happens, they could very well capitalize on that. So again, that's why, you know, stressing the importance of, you know, the left within and outside Syriza that's willing to mobilize on the ground, for me, is very crucial at this point.
As Nantina Vagonsis, a graduate student in sociology at NYU, where she's also a union activist, she's been all over Athens in recent weeks, and you can read her writing on the Greek crisis on the Jacobin magazine website.
You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org.
That was my now 9-year-old, then 4-year-old son Ivan doing the station ID. I played it by special request from him. Back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of the 20th of the Goldberg Variations by Bach, performed by Bill Buckley's favorite pianist, Rosalind Turek. And now a rare poetic comment on the Greek situation.
Use your age-old age thick and liars in public places.
That was Ezra Pound reading a memorable phrase from Hugh Selwyn Moberly. Yes, he was a quasi-fascist, but he's right on this one. Next, Mark Blythe. Blythe is a professor of political economy at Brown. His book, Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, was published by Oxford University Press in 2013. He's got an excellent history of the Greek crisis on the Foreign Affairs website. Mark Blythe. The Greeks now have voted twice against austerity, first by voting in the Syriza government and then the other day by very dramatically voting no in the referendum. Do you think the preferences of the Greek population have any weight in this debate?
No, none whatsoever. I was talking about this the other day to someone who was doing another interview, and they said, you know, so democracy matters in this case. And I said, well, sadly it doesn't. It's a bit like my four-year-old voting against bedtime. Right? At the end of the day, it really doesn't matter because executive authority lies elsewhere. What's really become plain at this point, and it is very dramatic and very disappointing and very worrying, is the role that the ECB is playing. So if you think about it, the main function of the ECB is twofold. Number one, ensure financial stability. So what are they doing? They're choking emergency liquidity assistance to the Greek banks to keep them not just on a short leash, to basically make sure that they run out of cash before we have the big meeting on Sunday. So this is a political intervention. And the second one is maintenance of payment systems. So again, you know, as Martin Sandow said in the FT the other day, if you think that that's being done well, just go ask some Greek pensioners how the payment system is functioning at the moment. So democracy has basically enraged the Euro elites, and now they seem to be using the ECB to basically force the Greeks to do something against their will yet again.
This is like everything a central bank is not supposed to do. They are deliberately engineering bank failures.
Completely. That's exactly what's going on, and it's an absolute scandal. Now, of course, they can say, well, it's the collateral rules, and they don't have enough collateral. But by the same token, the Greek banks are capitalized at 18%. They should be able to lend up to 81%. What they're doing is basically a trickle, a fraction of that. Now, this is because they don't have the quality collateral, but they write the collateral rules. So if the prime directive, to use a geek metaphor, is to ensure financial stability, they seem to be doing the exact opposite.
It looks to me that the whole reason behind this is to make an example of Greece. They're, you know, basically shooting Greece to encourage the others. Is that what you see is going on?
Well, yeah, it's a nice way of putting it. Yes, that's exactly what's going on. I've long maintained that what's going on here, and I said this in a piece in Foreign Affairs with Cornel Bahn back in January, that what's really going on here is not economic risk. It's basically political risk. And the political risk is you've had particularly center-left parties that for the past two decades have been, you know, the Social Democrats in Germany, New Labour in Britain, essentially the handmaidens of a creditor's paradise. And now the creditors have shown their true colors and they want to be paid at 100 cents on the dollar. And they're the kind of reluctant and sometimes not so reluctant enforcers of this. As a result, they've been losing vote share left and right to anti-austerity parties and nationalist parties. One can look at the British election as a great example of this. Labour's defenestrated. Where did it come from? From the anti-austerity party, the Scottish National Party, and also from UKIP in the north of England, coming second in all these constituencies and destroying the Labour vote. So you've got these centre-left parties that are seeing themselves being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. And what does Syriza represent? A mortal threat, not just to the European project, but to the very existence of those parties.
You gave a speech to the German Social Democrats last year, right?
Yeah, basically warning exactly this. I stood up in front of 600 of them and said, you are the second-rate, second-hand enforcers of a creditor's paradise, and if you don't watch out, you're going to be out of business permanently pretty soon. And my message wasn't, therefore, you need to kill Syriza. It was quite the opposite. If you don't start talking to these people and you continue to undermine them in the democratic process and by non-democratic means like we're seeing with the ECB, then what's coming next is much worse. Let's think about it this way. Go back to a couple of weeks ago, the deal that was on the table. As many people have pointed out, this is what they would have signed up to. Imagine you didn't have Syriza. Imagine you had some nice centrist white boys in sensible business suits signing the agreement, right? I promise that the fifth oldest economy in the world is going to grow at about 25 to 30% higher than its historic average for the next 30 years. It's simultaneously going to run a 3.5% budget surplus for the next 30 years. It's going to hand over 4% of GDP every year for the next 30 years to foreign creditors. And all of that's actually going to happen in an economy that's lost 30% of GDP and is now little more than a rounding error in the Eurozone. So you undermine Syriza, you get what in its place? Either clothy of idiots who are going to sign another extend and pretend agreement as the economy shrinks to the size of a walnut, or something far worse on the right.
What do you think of the IMF's role in this? They were sounding dovish last week, but what are they in the run-up to that, what have they been up to?
I've been trying to work it out. I mean, you know, if you'd asked me a month ago, like, okay, can somebody explain to me why Christine was really, really pally with Varoufakis when he came in, and now basically he's the comment about adults in the room comes out. Why it is that you've got Blanchard and the research department engaged in the battle of the boxes of the commission over negative multipliers, saying through the research quite consistently that austerity not only isn't working, it's actually the problem, and then that's completely ignored. And I think what we got with the release of the report that the Europeans tried to suppress at the end of last week that says, come on, this is a house of cards, it's unsustainable, is what the IMF's long game was. And the long game was this: we're going to be the tough guys because it's the only way we're going to keep the Europeans on side, as in the creditors. But we know this is extend and pretend. So what we really want you to do is somehow get this through your parliament, even though it's a fantasy agreement, and then we can come back and for real we're going to do debt reduction. The problem was there was no trust on either side for the IMF to play that role. So it kind of fell on deaf ears, and they just ended up looking like the hard cops for no apparent reason.
And the United States, what's the U.S. role been in all this?
Well, you saw that, you know, just after the vote went in, one of the first phone calls that Tsipras made was to Liu at the Treasury. He's spoken to Obama. Obama has said, come on, guys, this is a rounding error, get this sorted out. And they seem completely unable to do so. I mean, part of the problem here is what Europe has become isn't what the United States still thinks it is. So the United States still thinks that Europe is essentially NATO circa 1985. That is, you call the Germans, you call the French, and if you have to, you bring in the Brits to annoy both of them, and a deal is done. Unfortunately, now you've got the second in command at the Commission is the ex-president of Latvia, so not exactly somebody who thinks austerity is a bad idea. You've got the Poles, you've got Tusk screaming at people about the debt forgiveness for Greece is ridiculous, thereby completely forgetting the 50% debt reduction Poland got in 1991. And you have a whole host of actors now that make it incredibly difficult to even coordinate what Europe is and therefore what the United States can do with it. So you've got a bunch of angry Northerners who are pissed off at supposedly lazy Southerners. You've got a bunch of centrists in the middle in the big countries who are terrified of being out of a job to electoral cycles from now. And you've got incipient left and right parties licking their lips at the result of the collapse one way or another.
Well, let's step back into history some. How did we get here? How did Greece end up with such a high debt level? I do remember back in the misty past, talk of a convergence play. You could get, you know, as the euro was coming to an existence. What kind of flows of capital came into Greece from where and under what conditions?
We'll go back to that in a second. Let me tell you something I just found out. There's a friend called Ben Rosamond who teaches in Denmark, lives over the bridge in Sweden, and he sent me a picture, and I've tried to authenticate it, and I think it is authentic. It's an award, and it was given by a magazine that used to be called Euroweek. Do you remember Euroweek?
No, I missed that one.
Right, so it's a subscription-only kind of bond market devotee, very expensive insider information mag. It's now called something like Global Capital or whatever, right? It's one of these things you look it up and you have to subscribe to it, right? So anyway, in 2007, guess who they gave the award for Sovereign Borrower of the Year to?
Let me guess, Greece.
You got it, absolutely, right? That's up there with Transparency International saying that Iceland was the most transparent place in the world. But anyway, point being, why were the markets falling over themselves to give money to Greece? If you look at the exposures that the BIS got their hands on, the first real accounting of this we had in 2010, the Germans were in for $62 billion, and the French were in for $92 billion. And this was partly buying bank subsidiaries and doing all this sort of stuff as well as actual lending. But what you had prior to this, the whole decade, was you had this weird thing where you bring in a common currency. And what that does is encourage common banking, that everybody's borrowing in a foreign currency. And you've got that convergence play you mentioned, whereby everybody's paying real interest rates on their bonds that reflect default risk and devaluation risk. And once you take those out of the bond by breaking up and burning your printing presses, they all converge. Now, if you know that they're coming in, if that's coming in, if that's going to happen, that nice little 25% you get for just sitting on Greek debt is going to disappear. So how do you make money on the declining spread? You basically pump up the volume. You increase the leverage on your balance sheet. You borrow more against those assets, and then you lend more against against those assets. So the asset footprint of the European banks got twice as big as the Americans, and their internal operating leverage got twice as big. And they're all interlinked across a continent, using a currency none of them print. So if any of them get into trouble, there's nobody there except the ECB. And it turned out the ECB, run by Trichet, was essentially a think tank running a currency board fighting the 1924 inflation. So when the whole thing hit the fan, there was very little in place that could actually deal with the problem.
When did Greece start cracking?
Greece started cracking earlier than we actually recall. So the standard story says, you know, Papandreou comes in and, you know, classic case of good intentions gone bad. He fesses up to the fact that the prior government had been cooking the books. Well, they'd all been cooking the books, and we know this. And the budget deficit is actually 15%. And everybody freaks out in the yield spike. Well, hang on a minute. At that point in time, this is 2% of the Eurozone. They've got a 15% budget deficit. I mean, at best, that's 0.3%. I mean, that's a rounding error. Why is everybody freaking out over this, right? Well, there's two stories going on. One is the spikes were going up beforehand because of lots of things to do with collateral and repo markets, but leave that to one side. The bigger play here is all those big levered European banks are sitting there, not just on Greek debt, but also on Portuguese and Irish and Spanish real estate loans and Greek banks that they've bought and so on and so forth. So if that 0.13 is allowed to go bang, those highly levered banks are going to have to sell Portuguese assets to cover it. And if I see you doing that, you know that I'm going to do it and the next bank's going to do it. And then suddenly we're all selling Ireland to cover our Portuguese losses. So what was being priced in as the yields went up, and Greece was the trigger, the catalyst, the weakest link here, was essentially a bond market bank run that was basically going to run through all the bond markets of Europe and end up basically blowing up the balance sheets of French and German banks, and that was never going to be allowed. So the reason that you kept the Greeks in the memorable words of Geithner, you kept their foot on the Greeks' neck, was to keep the Greeks in so that the yields stayed down, so that with enough liquidity you could calm the fires.
It seemed like the authorities were rather disorganized and delayed in their response.
It's a two-year delay, absolutely. Basically, what happened was some of them at least were aware of the problem. But then the whole narrative took over at that point of, well, we've expanded so much and now we need to be austere and we need to cut. Now, look, there's no doubt about it. If you've got a 15% deficit, you're out of market access, and you basically want to remain solvent, you are going to have to do a budgetary adjustment. So austerity, to a certain extent, is written in the script. But when you pile it on with draconian cuts and various interventions and conditionality and all the rest of it, you're just simply making the whole situation worse. Plus, what we had at that point in time was essentially Trichet running a currency board and a think tank. They didn't even think of themselves as a lender of last resort. So the result of this was those 20 Merkozy summits where nothing got decided. The markets got more and more freaked out. And it wasn't until Draghi came in late 2011 and dumped the big LTRO dump in 2011-2012, €1.5 trillion of public money hitting the markets, that the yields actually went down and things calmed down. In the meantime, Ireland, Portugal and Greece had been through a draconian austerity programs that did no good whatsoever. And the way we know this is France's yields went down just as much as Greek yields went down proportionally, and the French couldn't hit a deficit target with a banjo tied to a cow's backside.
I'm speaking with the economist Mark Blyth of Brown University. A few years ago, everyone was worried that of contagion. If Greece blew, then all of Europe would blow. Now the thinking is that, you know, Spain is, if not thriving, more or less okay. Ireland is recovering. So now we don't have to worry about a Greek problem, and we can just, like, screw them and make an example of them.
Yeah, that's the thinking. I mean, there's a certain amount of truth to this, because what happened in the 2012 Greek bailout was, after the 2010 bailout essentially made the bankers whole, because depending on how you count it, between 65% and 90% of that money went straight through Greece as a conduit right into the hands of those French and German banks to basically make sure the bonds are okay. The ESFS, I can never say this, the European Financial Stability Facility, then did a debt buyback through the Greek government that took the debt from the banks and stuck it in this big container now called the ESM. That plus the other loans given out by the Europeans all sit there. So if Greece defaults, they take a hit, and that's bad because they're going to have to explain to their taxpayers why they lost all that money, and they might even have to admit it was really just a disguised bank bailout that they didn't want to tell anyone about. But nonetheless, that's in principle containable. But you know what? Lehman had capital buffers of 12%. That should have been containable. So they are taking a hell of a chance if they think this is the case. But again, the real problem for me is political risk here. Once you signal that you're going to throw Greece to the wolves, what you're basically saying is that everybody is, either you have neoliberal creditor-friendly policies that are dictated from Brussels and or Berlin, or we will basically deal with you. And when you say that in the world's largest supposed democracy, you are emboldening the Farages. You are emboldening the Le Pens. You are emboldening the Syrizas. Everybody who is saying for different reasons, hang on a minute, what's going on here? Isn't this meant to be about democracies and nations and representation? What the hell?
Well, but the whole Euro project was never about anything like that in the first place.
No, it never was, but it was meant to converge to that. I mean, if you go back and you look at Mitterrand's biography, if you look at the speeches of people like Prodi and others, they were the people who were saying, look, this is the first step, and then we're going to pull sovereignty, and then we can think about some kind of like 10% budget tax for our national treasury and blah, blah, blah. And of course, none of that ever happened, because when those guys were swept out in the mid to late 90s, the people who replaced them, the Blairs, like let's call them, you know, let's say the consultant for Middle East dictators, and then you've got Schroeder, the minister for Gazprom. They were basically replaced by a bunch of opportunists who basically didn't care about the project, lived through a giant credit bubble. So when it all went bang, the foundations that had been laid by the Prodis and the Mitterrands and others and the Coles was simply too shallow to support what happened.
I interviewed Yanis Varoufakis a while back. He said that he thought that that Mitterrand and Kohl knew that this was a crisis-prone system, but the crisis would provoke institutional growth that would lead to something like fiscal union and more coherence in the structure, the European structure. Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, funny thing, here comes a book plug. I just did a book with a guy called Matthias Matthias. It's called The Future of the Euro, Oxford University Press, 2015. And in one of the chapters, Matthias actually examines this claim empirically. And he says, okay, let's look at all of the crises the European Union has faced, and then let's look at when they've done institutional spurts of growth. And there's zero correlation, because this is the first real crisis it's actually faced. And they've certainly built new institutions, but if you're talking about things like the fiscal compact and everybody must run a budget balance, if not a surplus, it's not clear that these are actually adding to, helping the problem or basically accelerating the problem.
So where are we now? It looks like there's going to be a collision on the weekend unless Syriza completely rolls over. What happens then?
There's a long-term play and a short-term play. So the short-term play is I think they're out. Unless the IMF and the Americans have behind the scenes basically scared the Germans to death about the likely consequences, basically the German finance minister has the upper hand and they're out, and it's going to throw them to the wolves time. Now, if that means that Greece goes through 6 months of turmoil and then pulls in Argentina and grows at 7% a year for 4 years, that's going to create problems. But that's down the line for the Euro elites. And what they're thinking is, look, as you said earlier, Spain's growing, Ireland's a success, Portugal we don't want to talk about, so we'll be fine. Okay, but let's think about where we really are. Spain's been growing at 2%. Not exactly a rocketing out, is it? It still has very, very high unemployment. And the apologists will say, well, it always has, right? Not quite true, but whatever, right? You still have very, very high youth unemployment. You've got stagnant real wages, and the standard plan for basically European growth is more wage compression, because, of course, demand doesn't matter in this worldview. You look at Ireland. Ireland has the same population as Brooklyn, New York. The way that they managed to avoid a huge crunch in the crisis when they did their adjustment was by basically banking Apple, Google, and other profits from Europe with 12.5% corporation tax and then booking that as a services export. It's a one-time trick. Nobody else gets to do that. So Ireland has grown, but they've lost 50,000 graduates a year for 5 years who may not be coming back. That's their future tax base. Greece, right, is the fifth oldest country in the world, but Portugal's old, Italy's old, demographics matter. It matters because people will basically hold on to bonds and will not invest in equities, which means that you've got corporate financing problems down the line, ignoring everything else. So you're looking at high unemployment, low to zero wage growth, and basically sort of a miserable economic existence as Europe spends the next 20 years trying to pay down debt that it owes itself, which is just, you know, that's the good scenario. So the bigger play here is, yes, it's going to be important what happens to Greece, but what really is important is what happens to Europe. Let's say that they keep Greece in. They do extend and pretend, or they even actually do some kind of de facto debt forgiveness. Well, at the end of the day, if the policy mix is still keep constricting, and we'll see where we go, then you're just going to end up again with this low-growth, kind of crappy economy.
What's in it for the Germans? Are they in it to make a moral point about paying debts? In it to torture the what they see as the greasy, lazy Greeks? Or is there some material advantage they get out of this?
Well, probably a bit of both. I mean, you know, there's different set. I mean, the export sector is shedding labor but still makes a hell of a lot of money. The sector that's growing in employment is the service sector, because Germany historically had a very small service sector. The Hartz reforms turbocharged that, but it did so with many jobs and incredibly low wages, to the point that they had to bring in a national minimum wage. So, you know, it's not clear that this is a sustainable policy mix. The Germans essentially rely on everybody else's stimulus. So you go to the garage in my building, it's like a monument to German car exports, right? So long as everybody else is growing, they're fine. But, you know, as Martin Wolf has pointed out for years, we can't all play that trick. So I don't think there's a conscious German strategy of mercantilism or begging thy neighbor. And I actually don't think there's a let's punish the Greeks because they're all lazy, because we really believe that, the Bild-Zeitung view of the world. I think there's elements of both of those things going on. But most of all, it's a kind of, we're all right, so why isn't everybody else all right? A kind of complacency. And this is leading to a great deal of petty nationalism and anger, which is deeply damaging to the European project. If you had a look at Thomas Piketty's interview in Die Zeit, to say that he doesn't pull his punches is putting it mildly. He kind of loses his rag completely and just says, you guys have no right to talk to anybody about debt or debt relief. You got it four times in the 20th century. And he said, well, isn't that completely different? He says, well, why is it completely different? And then he stopped short of saying, you know, well, Greece hasn't actually started a war that killed millions of people, but he got bloody close. So, you know, tempers are fraying. The notion that we're all in this together has been really, really seriously damaged. It's created a north-south, us against them, saints against sinners. And even if you wish away all the economic problems, that's going to stick around, and that's creating a poisonous politics that's exactly what's destroying, in part, the centre-left, as well as being the second-hand enforcers of a creditor's paradise.
And so, say Greece exits sometime soon, what then?
Good question. We'll find out if there's a layman moment or not. If I had to put money on it, I would say it will be reasonably contained. You will have a great deal of volatility for about 3 to 4 months. The euro will boomerang up and down for a little while and then settle down. And what people will figure out, I'm saying sort of what market people will figure out, is that turns out that Greece is a rounding error. And the real risk is political risk, which they can't price. But the economic risk, so long as Spain keeps growing, in part because France is running a deficit, so long as Britain is growing, so long as the United States is growing, which helps Ireland, so long as Portugal can be triaged and nobody notices their enormous debt pile, then things will basically soldier along and Europe will recover in the sense that, you know, if you have influenza, a debilitating case of diarrhea, you're completely dehydrated and you spend a week in hospital, your second day off the bed on fluids, you feel a lot better.
And what about Greece?
Well, you know, this is where the sort of the criticisms of Greece of being sort of venal and corrupt and all this sort of stuff come into it. Which is, you know, my line on it is the following. So all the banks that lent Greece all that money, if they didn't know that they were venal and corrupt and lazy and a taverna society and all the stuff that they say now that explains things, supposedly, then their due diligence people should be taken out and shot. Because how could you not spot that? You should never have lent to these guys. On the other hand, if they knew all that and they lent to them, they should all be on a RICO warrant because basically this is racketeering and money laundering. And it's funny how none of those perspectives come up. It's just their fault all the time. One of the good things about the Greeks going out, if they had to fall out, is it really is all on them. Vilim Butier at Citibank, chief economist, has got a really nice plan for basically, look, get the ESM to recapitalize their banks, no more programs, leave them on their own. They'll need to balance their budget and then get market access and rebuild credibility. And that gives Greece as a society an opportunity to do what it's never had a chance to do, in part because the EU made it too easy, which was to solve the schism of the Civil War, which was to get over the Colonel's period, which is to tax the oligarchs, which is to basically create a more equitable, fair and transparent society. But that can't be done from Brussels. That has to be done for the Greeks themselves. And for so long, particularly sort of upper middle class intellectual Greeks, Europe has been this wonderful thing that if it wasn't for Europe, we'd still be a corrupt third world society. Well, by some accountings, you are, and you need to sort that out. And it's not Europe that can do that for you, using that as a crutch.
I was Mark Blythe, professor of political economy at Brown. You can find his most recent essay on the Greek crisis on the website of Foreign Affairs magazine. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Glenn Gould playing the same Goldberg variation number 20 that we heard Rosalind Turek playing earlier, except he plays the whole thing in less time than she took to play just the second half. Till next week, bye.